Mr. Parkinson, real one. Where were you born, please?
I was born in London, 1915.
What did your father do for a living, please?
He was a Methodist minister.
Did you go to school in London?
Yes, not in London. I was too small. He had moved to Croydon by the time I was too late. And I went to Croydon High School from the age of 4 and a half.
And then, after that?
Well, then my father was moved to Brisbane in Manchester in 1924. And for 3 years, we lived in Brisbane, and I attended
So you regard Croydon as your hometown, really?
Yes.
I think you went up to the university at 18. Where did you go to? To read? And when did you finish there?
1936.
Did you get a job?
Yes, I came as an October Hill housing manager, which took 18 months, and then I got a job in Lincoln.
Were you in Lincoln when war broke out?
Yes.
What was your reaction when you heard Neville Chamberlain declare war on Germany?
Naturally, extremely depressed, because I was a Methodist, and I really was so torn in my feelings as a young man.
How had you come to be a pacifist?
I think I'd been thinking very seriously about it, and I'd joined the Democratic Movement of this trade union, and been active in that.
Whereabouts had you joined and been active?
In Kim. I became secretary of one of the local groups, and we did a lot of work together. Trying very hard to think about the implications and the possibilities and studying families, non-violence, and getting thoughts about all sorts of relevant subjects.
Was this the Peace Pledge Union?
Yes, we did.
How strong a unit was there in Croydon of the PPU?
At one time we had, I could think, at least 10 different small groups in different parts of Croydon who were supporters of the PPU. It was a very strong time.
Which years would those have been?
Oh, 36 or 38,
Do you remember any of the leading lights and activists?
Yes, I'm still in touch with a couple of them. One of them was Mark Taylor, who was a conference secretary in the House for the War, about, I think, people have a lot of their thoughts in the Imperial Museum connected experiences as a conference subjective in the First World War, and he was a local baker. Apart from that, I don't think we have any well-known people from the Croydon groups.
What did the activity mostly consist of? Was it just meetings and discussions?
Meetings, discussions, study groups,
Was there anything in the way of going out to the public, like leafleting or knocking on doors?
We did have some public meetings. I remember I actually addressed the public meeting because the speaker had gone out. In the open air, I can't say I can remember exactly what the focus was or what year it was. But we did have a campaign in 1930, I think it was 1738, the Carlisle to London campaign, and and it's one of the groups that have folks that travel all the way from somewhere else to London, discussing on the way and having meetings on the way at different places.
Did you meet any leading lights from the National Conscientious Objector Movement? Was that in Croydon that you met him, or in London?
No, it was at a conference in London, a PBU conference.
What kind of response did you get from the general public? Was it friendly or hostile or indifferent?
At that time, I think it was reasonably friendly, until, of course, the time of the war itself. I think everybody had such a horror of war anyway that they responded fairly positively until that was coming to the outside of the door. After which it was very different.
Was there in Croydon, whilst you were living here pre-war, any notable Mosleyite movement?
I can't remember. No.
They weren't prominent on the streets with their demonstrations?
No, I don't remember.
You were telling me about how upset you were about the declaration of war when Chamberlain made it.
Mm.
What had you thought about Chamberlain's policy of attempting to avoid war with Germany?
I suppose that many people believed that war hadn't broken out, but a deep sort of wonders it's come out of the possibility.
Were you in any of the early bombing of Britain by the German Air Force?
Well, we got back to Croydon from where we came in 1950. There was still quite a lot of bombing going on. And Croydon suffered extremely badly in the winter months in the 1954. I was working in Richmond between 1950 and 1953.
Can you describe any of the bombing experiences that you had?
I think there were various small incendiary raids that took place, and some fire rocks in the rest of the street and so on. I wasn't going up to London during that time. I was going across the Cold of the Eastern. I can't say there was any major bombing. Most of it had happened shortly before I returned to Croydon, where we had a couple of landmines in Croydon. Our house had all its windows blown out, and we were losing the Oh, so then
How do you think public morale stood up to the bombing?
Remarkably well. And I think that it comes in that behind those areas really are really concerned.
Did you ever come across anybody whose morale was shaken or who wanted, as a consequence, to come to an agreement with the Germans?
No, I can't say. kid, I think people would have been reluctant to vote for him if they voted in the half hour.
Did you use public shelters yourself? You were telling me a story earlier, and perhaps if you could repeat about the start of the V1 raids.
Yes. I had got a job with a housing association in the East End of London. And in 1944, we had the offer of the use of a hut out in Kent, which belonged to one of the committee members, to use as a sort of camping holiday centre. And a friend and I took a party of five girls from Waterloo Green down to this hut in Searle, Kent, for the weekend in the summer of 1944. And these youngsters were not used to the country, and it was quite hard work to help them to enjoy the experience. But overnight, we had our secret there, and our phone phenomenon of some sort of aircraft passing overhead, first to one side and then to the other side of the front, a regular interval with a sustained cuttering noise, and couldn't make it out at all. But when we got back to London after the weekend, I heard people saying, "Did you know that it was a pilotless plane that had come over to come down in Waterloo Green?" And my first reactions were, the stick of rumours that go around during Waterloo, whoever heard of it, pilotless plane. In fact, it was the beginning of what we typically call the V1.
In what way were these children unable specifically to enjoy the countryside?
Well, they weren't particularly in trees or flowers or birds or wildlife. The only tremendous holidays they had were because of the funfair and other holidays. And apart from holidays and being warm, we found it very difficult to get an interest in the wildlife or anything like that.
How much did deprivation in the Second World War in a place like Bethnal Green compare with nowadays?
I think it was considerably more. There wasn't anything like the sports services that we have now. In fact, the families that I was in contact with were, on the whole, better off than me, because they were in housing for the local flats. Of course, our job was really to be a working citizen of Advance Bureau. There were no citizens of Advance Bureau until the war. And in fact, I could tell former housing manager, I would possibly be the only educated person that the students were in touch with. So that when it came to filling forms or advice about people's wages or fixing problems, they would normally turn to the landlady and say, you know, what can I do about this? And one of our dogs once went up to the raising bed, providing the parents to the appropriate place to open the particular problem.
Can you tell me about the question of crime during the Second World War as far as you experienced it? What was the level of crime like? Did you get looting of bombed houses or people taking advantage of the blackout?
I don't remember anything like that. What might have happened, but it certainly hasn't stuck in my memory as a picture at the time. What a remarkably little crime, considering what it might have been.
Did you feel unsafe as a woman going about in the dark, in the blackout? What about the issue of national unity in the Second World War? Do you think there was national unity? Where do you think it came from? Do you think it came spontaneously or from government propaganda or what?
No, I think it was more or less spontaneous.
Did you listen to Churchill's broadcasts in the war?
I suppose I must have heard most of them. I certainly tuned into the news and that sort of thing. I don't remember hearing any of them.
Did they have any effect on you? As far as morale was concerned? What about Lord Haw Haw? Did you listen to him? Now, can you tell me how you came to go to Belsen, please?
Well, during the war, the Quakers had been saying, we've got to look at him, we've got to look at him for the peace, we've got to deal with, we've got to concentrate on reconciliation, and there's going to be terrible devastation, and we must be prepared to take our fear. So they started discussing groups already during the war, in preparation for the relief work after the war, and I didn't know in one of these discussion groups, would have moved to a bombing battalion that was in the time frame. And in due course, I was accepted, and I was sent us on a training course for 3 months in Hampstead to train as best we could for relief work in a devastated Europe. And I was and I paid it to the relief service team that was set up in 1944 in anticipation of the end of activities. And our team was put together with the usual mix of science and experience. And it was thought when we were preparing that we would be needed in the Netherlands because it was thought that the Germans in the ditch would blow up the barracks and flood the country. So it was in our last period of preparation we were learning plenty from that. And assuming that that's the nature of where we would be. But in fact, when we got over, we went over in February 1954, and we were in Belgium, and when we were in for waiting for the next move, the news came through about the British Army having an unprobability.
Excuse me, I think that must have been February 45.
45, sorry, my mistake, yes. We said February 44, and I know it was February 45. We had our move and orders from Antwerp to report to Boston. We weren't there. And our team was running 67. We were sent to Boston 6 days after we arrived there, 6 days after the army.
And it was called the Friends Relief Service?
Friends Relief Service, yes.
Whereabouts in Belsen did you actually work?
The women were all in the barracks that had been turned into a hospital for the reception of people from the camp. The men, some of them actually worked in the concentration camp before it was burnt down. But they didn't have any women in there because the conditions were too bad. But we were attacked. We were just blocked of the old cancer barracks where they detented the people from the camp.
So, did that mean you didn't see the worst of it?
No, we didn't see the worst of it. we saw the people coming out to be in a terrible condition. We saw that, but we didn't see the camp, the corpses, and the army or anything. We didn't know it was going to burn the world.
Can you describe the ceremony as you remember it, please?
Well, I remember a great crowd of people watching the flames burn, but what struck me very much at the time was that there was a big profile of Hitler, and it was a very long time before the flames could peak. And we had that 96 billion. So the flames in this field was being full of flames then. It was the people last year that left the home.
What specifically were you doing yourself at Belsen to relieve people?
Well, in the hospital, they had a team member in each block doing really a bit of coordination and administration and registration as far as we could do. Because one of the terrible things was if we didn't get people's names, nobody knew how they were going to their relatives at home. And one of the terrible problems was trying to recall people's names in languages that were unfamiliar to you. And trying to, when somebody gave you your name in Polish, you know, trying to write it down, still the language was quite hard. I have one very sad memory, which perhaps is worth recording. We had just one trained nurse on our team, so he was in overall control of the various blocks, depending on before the contingent of prisoners or whatever. And I had had in my block one incident where they brought in a contingent of women, because they were evacuating women and children first from the camp. And soon they had left themselves as women and got out of the camp with the priority group and burnt the tower until they were put through the cleansing station and stripped and so on. I couldn't send them back because there was no feeling about these two men who was telling them out to live. And they came into the work. And they were able to see how the other thing was. And I remember being given a home run and asked to report on what had been happening, and I had reported on various things. And I said, well, by the way, you remember those three men who got out of the camp? Two of them died yesterday, one died this morning. And without a flick of emotion, feeling said to him, oh, your home is all a nuisance, aren't they? And he suddenly looked at each other. So, my God, what have we come to? And we are cripples, and we come here from our humanitarian distance. And it's disgusting to think that such a skin had grown over, you know, susceptibility, that we could say such a thing.
You think that came from the terrible situation you were dealing with?
I think so. I think we sort of pulled on a sort of feel of each other.
So they were jumping the queue for what?
For being evacuated from the camp.
How do you think that, in general, the Friends Relief Service at Belsen functioned? Do you think it functioned well or not?
I think it functioned as well as anything could do in such circumstances. We were a very democratic group. We met regularly and discuss what we were doing and share our experiences. And on the whole, you know, I feel that we are doing as good a job as we could in very difficult circumstances.
Was it a big group?
No, we were 12.
Who was in charge, if anybody?
A girl called Lynn Inter, who was one of the only two men that was at that time. A woman in her 40s who was part of the organizer.
Did you see anything of those responsible for the situation at Belsen?
No, I don't think we did. We had people in the camp, of course, that was still active for some years, and SS let them down last year to clear the corpses, but. We didn't see that in the hospital, which was in my life.
Were you billeted on local German families?
No, we'd taken over empty houses.
Because I believe some people on the relief side were.
I don't remember that. As far as I can remember, I think we were.
Any contact with local Germans at all around Celle?
Not around it that period, when we were there.
What kind of overall effect did it have on your attitude towards life of having worked at Belsen?
Hard to say, and I think I haven't quite grasped the depth of human frustration could reach. But I think the thing that came across still appallingly was that when the Nazis treated people like animals, they became like animals. And then that was used to be proof for treating them like animals. Because one of the sad things today happened that one member of our team, the corporate, having heard another member of another team, who was there in a new contingent of Jews. People were brought into the camp who were in a particularly bad state. And of course, if that's what was being done, perhaps it didn't surprise me that the pictures had come aboard the group. And I thought that just hit the rock bottom. I don't know who the person was who was overheard to say it, but it was another English person.
How long were you... Did any of the people you were dealing with ever tell you or discuss with you what they had experienced?
Oh, yes. A lot of them were telling us about their experiences. And we had contact with some very fine people, one who'd been editor of a newspaper in Hamburg, Rudolf Kuchmeier. Everett tells about him in his account in that booklet.
This is called A Page of History in Relief.
That's right. And it's again written to one of my team members who kept very careful diaries and described such as letters.